Our first case this morning is McDonough Associates v. Schneider and Grunlow, case number 122702. Mr. Husak? Raise the podium if you need to. There's a button. Wrong way. That's not going to help.
They say in politics there are no second acts, so I'm not planning on going into...
You're fine.
There we go.
It can go even a little.
Let's hope I pass the second test. May it please the court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Richard Husak, counsel for the defendant's appellants, Bill Grunlow and Ann Schneider, in their official capacities as the Chief Procurement Officer of the Illinois Department of Transportation and as the Secretary of the Department. And I urge the court to reverse the district court's denial of their assertion of 11th Amendment immunity in this case for two reasons, because the relief requested by the plaintiff and granted by the district court enforced state law, not federal law, in violation of the 11th Amendment as made clear in the U.S. Supreme Court's Pennhurst decision, but also even assuming that any aspect of that relief represented the enforcement of federal law, it was not within the narrow exception to the 11th Amendment recognized in Ex parte Young, pursuant to which a district court can grant a prospective, injunctive, or other equitable relief to ensure ongoing compliance with federal law.
Before you dig into the merits, counsel, could you tell me what is still at stake in this appeal?
What is at stake is all the money that is claimed by the plaintiff under its payment claims, including all the money that the district court essentially ordered the state to pay over to the plaintiff.
Are there still pending claims, or were all the payments made?
All of the payments claimed were not made before this court entered its stay. Approximately $1.3 million of the roughly $1.98 million claimed by the plaintiff was paid. The plaintiff thereafter voluntarily dismissed its claims against the defendants in their individual liability, in individual capacities, and it also voluntarily dismissed its claim contesting the validity of the suspension of it as a department-approved contractor. But the payment claims are alive and well, and that includes both the payments that were already made by the state pursuant to the district court's disputed exercise of authority, so that if this court reverses and vacates on the ground that the district court had no authority or jurisdiction to enter that relief, what naturally follows is that the plaintiffs will have to make restitution for recovery that they obtained pursuant to an invalid order, and that's under longstanding, well-recognized principles. And if in the unlikely event that the court affirms the district court's judgment and says that this was a proper exercise of its authority under the 11th Amendment, my understanding is that the remainder of the payment claims, which are currently, or the issue of which is presently before the court, would go back to the district court, and the district court would order more processing of more payments to the plaintiff pursuant to the amounts that they claim to be owed.
And what the parties are referring to as the payment claim, which is the claim that you've explained is still alive in the case, is the claim for a due process violation stemming from this stop order that Mr. Grunlow entered. And it's unclear to me what form that took. Is it something distinct from the suspension order?
It is. And probably the easiest way to distinguish between the two is that the payment claims related to work that was done by the plaintiff before they filed the suit. The suspension order related to the department's order, or actually the chief procurement's order after a notice and a hearing, a two-day administrative hearing, preventing them from getting any new work. So when the suit was filed, we had two categories of work. One was work that they'd already done, And those correspond to the payment claims. They're saying that they were entitled to be paid for that work. And the other is work that they wanted to do in the future, but that the suspension order prevented them from having. They challenged on due process grounds, the suspension order, but they've since abandoned that. But they also challenged as a due process violation, and we vigorously dispute that characterization, but as a due process violation, the actions that they claim resulted in the non-payment to them when they wanted to be paid for work they had previously done.
And that action was some sort of an order by Mr. Grunlow placing a hold on any payments for work that was in progress or had already been performed?
That's the allegation, and it's verified by triple conclusory hearsay. But the district court accepted it as, you know, a valid basis for entering a TRO, but throughout, you know, expedited and quite extensive discovery, there has been not a shred of evidence that this supposed secret hold ever occurred. Mr. Grunlow, we all agree, as a matter of law, is a procurement officer. He signs off on new contracts and the letting of contracts for the state. He has no official role with respect to the processing of payments and the performance of those contracts. So the idea that he would have put some invisible secret hold on the processing of payments indicates that, you know, that he was acting totally out of the scope of his official responsibilities.
Is there any evidence that anybody in the chain of command put a hold on pending payments?
There is none, actually. No. If you look at the dispute with respect to the underlying state law rights, to the extent they had a right to be paid, you can break it down into several categories. One is the claims that they had for work that they did without an executed contract. And our position is a matter of state law. They didn't even have a state law property interest being paid for that work.
The contracting process is kind of complicated and multi-layered, and there's a dispute of fact about what that process entailed as a legal matter and what it entailed as a practical matter, apparently.
But even if it's a practical matter and you're arguing under some custom and practice theory, it's still state law. There's no federal law that requires the state to pay somebody for work they did under an unexecuted contract if there's a pattern and practice of later executing those. And I would emphasize that there's an important distinction in this case. The district court essentially accepted their theory that, oh, well, you sign these prior approval letters with a $50,000 limit on the amount that you can get paid for work, but those are routinely ignored, not when somebody has subsequently been suspended for overbilling the state for close to $2 million based upon taking work that was done on other projects and calling them overhead and billing the state for it. This is taxpayer money that the plaintiff put into their pockets based upon misrepresentations as to the nature of that work. And the district court said, oh, ignore that. The state can't implement an offset pursuant to state procedures that would prevent the plaintiff from getting what it wants first before the state liquidates and gets restitution for the amounts that were previously overbilled. So there's the unexecuted contract category. Then there's the overbillings restitution issue where the plaintiff said they can't prevent us from getting paid first.
Do you have a claim for restitution?
Pardon me?
Do you have a claim now for restitution?
Not in this case, not in the federal district court.
That's governed by the 11th Amendment too, isn't it?
Pardon me?
That's governed by the 11th Amendment, too,
and there's a serious concern that if we'd followed the district court's invitation to file a counterclaim, we would have subjected ourselves to the court's jurisdiction, which we were not going to do. Our position was that there was no federal law duty to pay them any of this money. There was no federal law obligation to process payments. The confusion that the district court made was it lost sight entirely of the difference between what due process requires and making payments. And, of course, that was all sort of obscured under the semantic ambiguity of processing. But what due process requires is notice in a hearing at which they have the opportunity, an outcome-neutral hearing, at which they have the opportunity to try and establish their right to recover the money that they claim. It doesn't mean processing invoices.
Right. The remedy for a due process violation is not payment, but more process.
And process out in an outcome-neutral fashion. And I think the record is clear that the district court repeatedly indicated that this so-called processing that he was talking about and that the plaintiff wanted wasn't give them a hearing at which they could seek to establish that they had a right to be paid at some time for work they'd done that was acceptable, regardless of the fact that they didn't have an executed contract for much of it, and regardless of the prior overbillings. What he was ordering was process their invoices in the ordinary course,
And in the transcript, he made it very clear what that meant. And this is in our reply brief at page 12, the record document 31 at page 8. When people engage in the ordinary course of business, they pay their obligations. What is clear is that the district court was ordering process in the sense of pay these people because they came in saying that if you didn't pay them right away, they would go out of business, and that was the justification for a temporary restraining order. And I would urge that for the two reasons we have invoked here is that the district court was enforcing state law against state officials in their official capacities, and that the relief order did not fall within the ex parte Young limitation, this court needs to send a clear signal that this type of relief is totally beyond the confines of what is permitted by a district court entering relief against state defendants in their official capacities.
Well, one would have thought that signal was sent in the Council 31 versus Quinn case.
We would have thought so, too, but this district court judge didn't seem to think that the 11th Amendment was any bar here whatsoever. He characterized this relief as a prospective relief to prevent an ongoing violation of federal law.
Is it clear that as a practical consequence of the suspension order, the remaining signatures on the pending payment claims, or the pending contracts, apparently some of them are unexecuted contracts and some are almost fully executed payment claims, everything but the payment has yet to be done? Is that a fair characterization?
I think that there were some amounts in dispute that involved an executed contract. And then there were other amounts for which there was no executed contract, although work had previously been done. And then the suspension order essentially said no future work, no more work to come from the department for the next 3 years.
Right, but as a practical, that's my the import of my question, as a practical consequence of this contractor having been suspended, the state isn't going to pay out pending claims. Or is there no record on that?
Not for any new work, not for any new contracts. The suspension order, however, did not prevent the state from ultimately paying the plaintiff or giving them a credit against the overbilling amounts for acceptable work they did pursuant to a previously executed contract. The suspension order had nothing to do with preventing them from getting paid or getting a credit for acceptable work they did where they had an executed contract. But it did prevent the execution of new contracts for new work. And in this case, the district court's order, I think the violation of the 11th Amendment is even clearer by virtue of the fact that he essentially said that the Secretary of the Department of Transportation herself, under threat of contempt sanctions, was ordered to sign a contract that was necessary as a matter of state law to authorize payment to the defendant, to the plaintiff in this case, because the plaintiff had this argument that as a matter of state law, that's the way it's always done. Well, if that's a matter of state law, the district court judge has no authority to enforce it against state officials in this case.
Is there a state administrative remedy for this sort of a dispute?
Oh, there certainly is. Yes, for the suspension claim, they could have sought administrative review but have never done so. But for the payment claims, they can go to the court of claims. That, this court has already held, satisfies the due process requirements of notice and a hearing. And to the extent that they believe they were entitled to be paid and there was an alleged breach of contract by the defendants by halting the processing of payments, then the due process remedy would be to pursue a court of claims action against the state. And that satisfies due process. This case would have been different if the state had said, no, we're not going to give you notice, we're not going to give you a hearing, you don't have any chance to establish your state law right to be paid or to receive a credit for work you did under an executed contract or even, as you claim, under an unexecuted contract. And the district court said, I'm ordering such a hearing.
It would be different. It would be different, but does your theory depend upon the availability of state court procedures? I thought you were claiming a broader 11th Amendment immunity.
We are. All I'm doing is pointing out that the claim here was not one based upon a federal right to due process. It was based upon enforcement of state law rights. Mm-hmm. Every time you turn around, what you see is the district court is accepting and incorporating into its order an element of state law that the plaintiff involved. We have the right to be paid without an executed contract. We have the right to be paid now, even though the state claims we've overbilled them for $1.8 million. Those are, if anything, state law rights. Due process does not require processing of invoices. If there's any right to processing of invoices, as they claim, that's a state law right. Every time you turn around, what they're doing is saying state law gives us this right, and therefore the district court should enforce it against the state. But due process does not require the processing of invoices. I see that my time is short. I'd like to reserve the rest of my opening time for rebuttal, if I may.
That's fine. Mr. Sullivan.
Good morning, Your Honors. William Sullivan on behalf of the plaintiff appellee. May it please the court. The record of facts as it was presented to this court is a complete distortion of what occurred. In approximately December of 2011, William Grunlow ordered the head of the Bureau of Design, which under state regulations is the only part of the Department of Transportation which can determine eligibility to take new contracts, to declare them to be ineligible. My client wasn't told about it. My client didn't become aware of it until after ultimately a decision in an administrative hearing was rendered against it.
That claim has been dismissed. The suspension claim has been dismissed.
Well, I understand that. My point is that what we have here is a calculated series of events that demonstrate that what was done by Mr. Grunlow was a gross interference with the impartial administration of public procedures and rules relating to the processing of property rights. And contrary to what was said by Mr. Huzzack, the law is that even property rights can be elevated by explicit understandings between the parties, even if state law declares that there can be no contract or that a contract was created in violation of state law. The Vail versus Board of Education case says that's too bad, where you have explicit understandings. And here's the way it worked, Your Honor.
That's a merits question. We have a threshold question about sovereign immunity. And how is this not a claim for payment from...
Because to go to a couple of the cases I think that were cited, I can give an example that might illustrate our position. The Edelman versus Jordan case, where the claims were denied, the court said prospective relief is allowed. But if the...
What's prospective about this?
Well, the prospective relief, Your Honor, was the relief saying process according to your own rules and regulations, because it's required by the due process clause. Don't interfere. What the court said is don't interfere with something over which you have no right to interfere. He had no colorable right to enter into the issue relating to the
as a matter
payment.
Of state law. He
as a matter of state
right.
law.
So what? It sounds like you're asking the federal courts to enforce state contract law and state contracting procedures.
No, on the contrary, Your Honor, what we were asking was only that he not interfere. Ultimately, because he continued to interfere, due process requires that...
Well, what you also sought relief against Secretary Schneider, right?
That's correct.
And, in fact, it's as I understand it, what's still in dispute here would be her and others' signatures on supplemental agreements and payments that were approved, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So forget about Grunlow for a minute.
All right.
You've got a federal district judge ordering state officials to execute contracts over which they have, as near as I can tell, discretionary authority to refuse to approve them, right?
Except, as we point out, Your Honor, one of their main officials, Mr. Baroncelli, and Mr. Young, who worked for my client, submitted affidavits. The affidavit said as follows, that a prior approval letter can allow a contractor, a consultant, to begin work after all of the scope of the work has been negotiated and the amount. We received those prior approval letters. The prior approval letters do say that you can only bill or do work up to $50,000. But the contradicted statement of Mr. Young is that the state routinely allows, and not only allows, but requires them to do more.
It sounds like what you're saying is that the Secretary of the Department of Transportation is required to sign contracts that she disapproves of as long as somebody two or three or four levels below in the food chain sent a prior approval letter.
No, that's not what I'm saying, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that she and Mr. Grunlow were aware, even after the interim suspension was created, that my client continued to work on those letter, on the, those matters for which prior approval letters were issued, as they always had. And they continued to build up an additional $1 million worth of work. They knew it because they had the documents from their underlings that said, what is the status? And in one of them, we said, they said there's a $2 million contract. They were actually a sub on that one. All the work has been done. They never said stop work.
I don't think you've answered my question.
Thank you. All right. But my point is that they never told my client that they would not sign those documents. They led them to believe they would sign those documents.
Is there any state law that controls whether the secretary and her chief counsel, for example, must sign and approve a contract?
I don't believe there is, Your Honor.
State law requires their signatures, correct?
Correct.
And presumably they're expected to use their judgment and discretion in deciding whether to do so, correct?
That's correct.
So under what conceivable theory is there a legal obligation, let alone one enforceable under the federal Constitution, to require that signature?
Board of Regents versus Roth, Bishop v. Wood, Perry versus Sinderman, Vail versus the Board of Education all say that they can these property rights can exist outside of state law if they are created by mutual and explicit understandings that would create an entitlement at a hearing.
Has the Supreme Court ever gone that far in public contracts? The cases you've just cited are all from employment.
Yes, that's correct.
Has the Supreme Court ever gone that far in public contracts?
Not that I'm aware of.
On the order of millions of dollars? I'm not aware of that either.
I am not aware of it.
Doesn't that seem like a fairly significant innovation?
No, I think it's an extension of the very same logic that the court used in those cases.
And could you address, I think, the reasoning? One of the things I was concerned about, this has more to do with your due process merits than with the 11th Amendment issue all by itself, but the Supreme Court's decision in the Lujan case against, I think, G&G, if I'm remembering correctly, where the Supreme Court said, in essence, look, if you're entitled to be paid, you've got a right under state contract law to pursue those remedies.
And the argument that's made by the state is that there was no contract, so you're not entitled to be paid. But
that's a merits issue, not whether there's an adequate remedy under state law that would resolve any due process problem.
Because these contracts should have been signed much sooner, because my client believed through representations made by the state that they would be signed sooner, it continued to do work, and that was put at the point of bankruptcy. Whether there's an adequate remedy is determined by the specific facts of every case. And in the Idaho versus Coeur d'Alene case, the Supreme Court said this is, in these areas, it's an exercise in line drawing. Here, the Secretary of Transportation and the Chief Procurement Officer knew that once there was the interim suspension took place, Your Honor, there was a notice set out that said you can continue to work on those matters on which you have already begun work through contracts. They being both the secretary and the chief procurement officer, were in fact aware that my client continued to work, was dealing with the department on a daily basis, that it was incurring a large number of hours that would result in payment. They never said stop. In fact, just the opposite was true. They said continue to work. Under those circumstances, and what Mr. Young also, who had administered hundreds of these things, 500 I think is what he put in his declaration, said he had never seen an instance in 21 years with the department or since where after a prior approval letter had been issued, there had been a refusal to sign or to execute a contract. And so what I've argued and what I think is correct based upon the 500 and so contracts that he himself administered on behalf of the state is that those signatures were ministerial, that they were perfunctory, and that the...
So now you're telling me that they were required. Telling me that there was total discretion as to whether to sign
them. Maybe I misunderstood you, and I thought you said, is there a law that requires it? And I think I answered that no. But what I am saying is it's ministerial in the sense that it's not
Well, it's still a matter of state contract law. I don't think you've gotten over that at all.
Well,
this is a pure contract dispute about a public contract for the state of Illinois.
I think
yours is a very creative theory, I think, but I don't think it's very valid.
I think what the district court found was that the interference with the court found that there was a property right in the contract and to be paid approximately $500,000 worth.
That doesn't have anything to do with the sovereign immunity issue, the 11th Amendment issue. If this is a suit against the state for specific performance of contracts, which it obviously is, that's sort of a claim in its essence, then the 11th Amendment bars it.
But I think what I'm suggesting, Your Honor, is that in order to raise a due process right, I have to have a protectable interest, and the protectable interest was that property right.
Not answering the 11th Amendment issue. How is this not a suit against the state for specific performance
because
of the contract?
I didn't mean to interrupt you. I apologize, Your Honor. Ultimately, what the court did was not determine that payment was due. The court left it, said process these things. If they had said that the work was beyond the scope of the contract, they didn't have to pay. If they said they breached the contract, if they didn't have to pay. They ultimately approved $1.5 million out of $2.2 million that were submitted, $900,000 of which was for contracts that had been signed off on. The point that I'm trying to make is the state had it within its hands. Mr. Huzzack said there should have been an impartial hearing, but we didn't need an impartial hearing. What we needed was somebody to review these things, and that's why I made the metaphor with Edelman. If the director had refused to accept the application, the court would have required him to take the application and review it, not necessarily to approve it, but to review it. The state came in and said, if we process these things, we're going to pay. That was the basis on which it wasn't the judge saying you have to pay. They, as much as admitted, we owe money. The result of which was they disapproved $700,000 worth. They did it for a number of reasons, none of which became before the court. Never once did the court put itself into the decision-making process as to whether something was due or not due. All the court did was say, do what you're supposed to do and process these things. And I would make one more metaphor. If the head of a prison intercepted an application for parole and hung on to it or told the parole board not to process it, the court could order the processing of it. The court wouldn't make a determination as to whether parole is due, but if somebody reaches into an area to deprive somebody of their right where they have no colorable legal authority to do so, under those circumstances, the court can, I think, say, I'm not going to tell you how this has to come out, but I am going to tell you, you have to do something. They have that right. And that's all that the court said, and that's why we believe it falls into the exception. And the Council 31 case was, it starts off by saying, this is a suit against the state of Illinois, the governor. We didn't sue the state of Illinois. And we didn't sue to compel the state to pay. Ultimately, that's what we wanted, just as people who apply for welfare rights want payment. What we sued was to remove the pollution created by the unlawful interference with the processing of payments by Grunlow. And I can represent to this court that in April I met with the people from the department, and I shouldn't go into it because I think it's not in the record. But the point I'm trying to make, Your Honors, is the court didn't determine what was going to be paid, if anything was going to be paid, if they had satisfied the contract, if they had delivered under the terms of the contract. All of those issues were left to the discretion of people in the state.
If you'd gotten the money, you wouldn't be here, right?
Well, I think, yes, Your Honor, that's true, but it would also be true of anybody who signed for welfare
stake.
Payments.
You claim you're going to go bankrupt if you don't get the money.
Yes.
Like a lot of other people who were contracted to the state of Illinois, apparently.
And, which is one of the reasons why the state remedies would not be sufficient.
As I said, I think it's a creative theory to get out of federal court, but I can't see if there's much more than a contract dispute.
And the whole import of the district court's balancing of the harms was about the money.
Under Roland B. Dresser, that's right. But under Roland B.
So the essence of the relief sought here was payment.
I think that's accurate in the sense that ultimately the state immediately came in and said, if we process these things, we're going to pay. And what we argued was that by not telling us that you weren't going to pay, and not only asking but directing my clients to continue to work.
My point is that the harm alleged here is not a lack of enough process. The harm alleged here is the non-payment, and that's the harm you were seeking to remedy on behalf of your clients based on this creative due process theory, and that's a suit against the state for specific performance of a contract, and the district court's TRO had the ultimate effect of ordering high state officials to execute contracts. And how is that not barred by sovereign immunity?
I think that although the cases that I've cited, the Perry versus Senderman et al., and Bishop V. Wood have not necessarily been extended to contracts of this size. It's the nature of the interest, not the weight of the interest. The nature of the interest was a property right.
Those were claims for more process, not for payment. You're not asking for more process. You're asking for payment.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. Huzzack, rebuttal. You've got a minute.
Plus three rebuttal.
Give him a minute.
You ate into your rebuttal time.
I didn't realize that. Thank you, Your Honor. I'll be as quick as I can. I think the court has put its finger on the relevant issues. This is a creative theory in search of monetary recovery against the state for alleged past wrongs. The ingredients that make up that theory are alleged state law rights. They're not federal law rights. He wasn't seeking process in the due process sense of a hearing. There is no federal court case that says that a federal court can order the state to implement state procedures for the processing of invoices in the face of the 11th Amendment. H.L. Mencken, I think, put it best when he said, when somebody says it's not about the money, it's about the money. And the fine distinctions between a breach of contract claim and what was going on here may be a testament to the resourcefulness that was put into trying to dress up this claim as one for not being for breach of contract under state law. But when you get to the bottom of it, that's what it is. Even if there were a federal law violation here, and leaving aside the property rights they claim versus the enforcement of state law rights, the due process versus state law issue, the 11th Amendment still would prohibit this because this isn't prospective equitable relief to prevent an ongoing violation of federal law like in the Milliken case, an equal protection violation for every day the students were being denied equal protection and the remedy necessary to redress that was in part to order the payment of money. These are past work, alleged non-payment for past work. The remedy was not prospective. It was not equitable. It was not for a violation of federal law. We urge the court to reverse and vacate all relief entered by the district court in violation of the 11th Amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.